to roll with the punches. Yeah, you got to go with the flow. Roll with the punches. Yeah, that's one thing I know.
Yeah, you gotta roll with the punches. Hi, everybody. Your old friend Mike Houlihan. Welcome back to Hibernian Radio, where we honor our Irish first responders. We're coming at you tonight from the garden here, the garden of the beautiful Cork and Kerry Irish Pub. We're brought to you by Local 150, Sheehy Funeral Home, Cork and Kerry, Fox's Pizza, Flood Brothers, Guinness, and Chicago Firefighters Local 2. So proud to have you all listening in. We've got a great guest tonight. 40 years in law enforcement, retired chief of detectives for the Chicago Police Department, Gene Roy. Gene, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So great to have you here. What a long and interesting career you've had. Let's go back a little bit to St. Joachim's.
St. Joachim's, yes, sir.
Oh, is that how you say it? Okay. At 90th and Cottage Grove. So when were you there? You grew up there? You were baptized there?
I was baptized at St. Joachim's and... lived in that parish until I was done with second grade. Started off my education at the Burnside, kindergarten at the Burnside School.
Okay.
Right across the street. And then, moved over to St. Joachim's for first and second grade.
Now, there was a police station over there in 91st and Cottage.
Right, the old Area 2,
yeah.
Burnside Station.
Okay. Tell me about that. That's where you first were introduced to cops?
It's an interesting story. You know, there was a ritual, and I'm sure many of your readers who or listeners who grew up or back there in the day, there was a ritual. You'd go to Sunday Mass,
yeah.
And you'd stop out for breakfast afterwards.
Sure.
There was a small family-owned restaurant named Iola's on the west side of Cottage, about a block north of the station, around 89th Street.
Yeah.
And that was our stop after church.
Yeah.
And it was also, if you were good in school during the week, it was the Friday evening ice cream sundae.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. Being that it was only a block north of the police station there, you know, I always attracted a lot of police officers.
Yeah.
You know, there were detectives, and then there were, you know, regular officers, traffic officers. They were always in there, and just very friendly and outgoing. And that's where I first got introduced to police officers.
Any police in your family?
No, I'm the first one.
Okay.
Now, my son has followed my footsteps.
Oh, yeah? What's his name?
Joe Roy.
Is he on duty now, or is he?
He is up in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, where he is a lieutenant on the Wauwatosa Police Department.
Oh, no kidding. Good for him. Yeah. Okay. So you liked these cops, and you said, I like
these cops, and, you know, it was something that, you know, that's probably what I want to be when I grow up. And that's where it started.
Yeah. Now, you went to St. Philip's at Jackson and Kedzie. What year? You transferred to Kennedy after that, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, because I went to Mount Carmel, and I graduated in 67, and I remember St. Philip's was a rough neighborhood.
It was a rough neighborhood. It was a very interesting neighborhood, too.
Yeah. You mentioned something about right across the street. Because there was no air conditioning. Tell me that story.
It's an old building, and there's no air conditioning there. Yeah. And like I said, a lot of different things going on there in that neighborhood. The first thing is there was a funeral home that was a crematory, an active crematory, right on the corner, maybe about 100 feet west of the school. So in the warm weather, when the windows were open,
yikes.
If the wind was blowing from the wrong direction, there was a lot of ash flying in the air.
Oh, man.
And it wasn't very pleasant.
And there was also a whore house around there, right?
Now, it's the other thing. You know, there are a lot of memories of being in English class, and there was a brother there who ran it, Brother Gabriel, and the windows would be open, and, of course, these houses of ill fame, as they were called, across the street, and, you know, when you're 13, 14, 15, certain things are a little more interesting than some brother teaching you about conjunctions and adverbs.
Yeah.
And the attention would get diverted. he would lose his cool and go around and slam the windows shut and start whacking people with his paddle to get their attention back. It was quite the place.
As you told me, it's a different form of sex education.
A different form of sex education, yes, sir.
Now, and this is weird, the King riots in April of 68 kind of killed St. Philip, huh?
Yeah, that was the end of it. Even before that happened, you know, the neighborhood was, you know, was really turning violent.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, there was a CTA bus barn across the way. It's still there, as a matter of fact. And the school had made arrangements with the CTA. They had a bus waiting for those going south and those going north.
Yeah.
So they would just get on the bus there, because a block north of the bus barn was Marshall High School.
Oh, wow.
And that would not have been a good mix, and there were more than a few problems with mixing people from St. Phillips and from Marshall. So, you know, CTA looked out for everybody, and there were no problems there. But, you know, the people would, there were a lot of people, and as a matter of fact, I was just talking to your son earlier before the show, and he's a lot of people he knows who live in Oak Park.
Yeah.
Went to Phillips.
Old West Side Irish.
And the old West Side Irish.
Yeah.
And the reason they did, it was very close. It was close to Oak Park.
Yeah.
Wasn't as expensive as Fenwick.
Yeah.
You didn't have to be as smart to get into St. Phillips as you had to be to get into Fenwick. And it was right there on the L.
Yeah.
But that came to an end after a couple of guys, and as a matter of fact, a couple guys from my class actually got stabbed in an armed robbery.
Wow.
And that was it. Yeah. And St. Philip's just, it closed.
Yeah. I'm sure your parents were happy to get you out of there anyway.
Yeah. They were.
So you went on the force in 1986. Tell me some of the people you met along your way. You worked in the old Wood Street District. And how old were you then? You're probably a young guy.
I was 33. Actually, my career in law enforcement started when I was 20 years old.
Oh, that's right. You started another place.
Right.
Yeah.
I started for what's now the Illinois State Police. I was with the what was then called the Illinois Bureau of Investigation, and the term they use nowadays is a telecommunicator. I worked on afternoons, and I was the radio operator and dispatcher for the investigators in the northern half of Illinois.
Yeah.
And that was another interesting job, a lot of responsibility, and here I was, a
20-year-old kid.
20-year-old kid.
Yeah. And so you're listening to what's going on.
What's going on. And and oftentimes when there were different surveillances going on, a lot of narcotics investigations at that time. That's when, you know, drugs first started hitting Chicago big time in the early 70s. And there were a lot of surveillances. And, you know, I would be like the quarterback on the radio.
Yeah.
Okay. Blue team, go to this location. Red team, stand down.
Yeah, yeah.
White team, do this. It was really a really fascinating job. And then I would get calls, too, from investigators who were out on the street. They're going to interview somebody. So they'd call on the phone and say, do me a favor, go and check the records and see what we know about this guy.
Oh, and you could do that right there,
You know, and I would pull out the reports and read the reports to him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, here I am, I'm 20 years old, and I'm getting a heads up on how to do criminal investigations.
Yeah, yeah. And how long did you stay there?
I stayed there for about 73. I was there for about 4 years.
Yeah.
4 years.
And then where'd you go?
I went to Chicago as a civilian. I worked for what was then the Office of Professional Standards.
Okay.
And investigated police shootings and allegations excessive force against the officers.
Yeah. And how long were you there?
I was there about 3 years.
Yeah.
And then you see a pattern already. It's hard for me to hold a job. So I went out to North Dakota.
You did?
I went out to North Dakota, married, and my wife at the time was from South Dakota, and we had two kids, and this will be nice out there, and, you know, we'll only be 150 miles away from the grandparents instead of 600 miles. We'll see them more often, so forth and so on. So went out there, and it was Wild West. I was doing narcotics investigations for the state attorney general's office.
Wow. Yeah.
It was before my hair turned gray, and I actually one time had to let it grow out and actually...
Oh, you're doing undercover stuff?
I was doing undercover stuff, too. So did a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, the strings of Chicago were tugging at my heartstrings, and I just wanted to come back.
Yeah.
And it gets real cold in North Dakota in the wintertime.
It gets cold here, too.
Real cold, okay. Serious cold. Yeah. You go for 2 weeks at a time where the high is 5 below.
So you've had cop in your blood for a long, long time.
Long time, yes, sir.
Yeah. And then you worked your way up. When you left, you were chief of detectives. That's a big deal. How long were you chief of detectives?
I was there for about just shy of a year.
You know, you have an interesting, you worked in narcotics, a homicide detective, a lieutenant, then a captain. You were promoted commander of the 9th District, and that's where you met Father Dan Brandt, one of my favorite people.
Father Dan Brandt.
At Nativity, yeah.
Yep.
So you had the Bridgeport, that's that station, basically.
I had the old Bridgeport station, 3501 South Lowe.
It's on Lowe Avenue, right across from the mayor's house, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about, Sox Park, and what is this? A federal agency landed a helicopter on the railroad tracks to bring families to White Sox games.
Oh, it's crazy stuff. Basically, you know, first of all, we're joking that Father Brandt and I were sent there to bring the White Sox to where they deserve to be. They need to win the World Series. I was brand new. I got there in February of 05, just before about 6 weeks before the season opener. Father Dan was there about the same time he took over Nativity. And, so that was a joke. And Phil Klein was the superintendent who promoted me and put me there. He used to joke about it. He said, we put you two guys here to make sure you got this done the right way.
And you did.
We did.
You brought a World Series to Chicago.
We tried our best, and we delivered.
Yeah.
We delivered. And it was just an interesting time. Here I am. I've been a cop for, at that point, just shy of 20 years. But this was a totally new dynamic because here on the one hand, I get it about cops and robbers and putting people on cars and making sure the cops are at the right place, looking for the right people at the right time. I get all that. But now you're talking about millions of people, literally millions of people coming in and out of Sox Park over the course of a season.
I was there, yeah.
And that is just something that the dynamics of that and the politics of that are just incredible.
And Mayor Daley was the mayor then, and that's his neighborhood.
And that was his neighborhood.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, there's an old joke that the people in the neighborhood were able to speak to him easier than Superintendent Klein was. And I don't think that's a joke.
No, I believe
I think that's reality.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting. The Sox started off okay that year. And around May or June, they started picking up momentum. And people started whispering. They didn't want to jinx it, but they started whispering. And I remember I was working the 4th of July, and I went there, and the game was sold out. And I just, something just clicked in me. I was in the stadium, and I saw the game, and it just clicked on me. The electricity, the vibe was in the air. I said, these guys are going all the way.
Yeah.
There was no doubt about it. And then we just...
I was at the drop third strike game.
I was there,
with
too.
With Brzezinski, yes.
I was there, too.
Up in the stands with Johnny Vegas Sheehan. Yeah.
I was there for every home game of the playoff series.
Yeah.
In the clinch games during the regular season.
Nice.
So for the last 2-3 months of the season, my whole life and my whole schedule was
all around
based upon what day could they clinch.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's what drove everything. But at the same time, I'm still running a district that's got 175,000 people in it. It's 14 square miles.
Is it that
and
big?
And 300 coppers.
Yeah.
So if something happens, the superintendent doesn't want to hear, I was at the park managing the crowds. Well, why weren't you at the shooting?
Yeah.
Or why something bad happened at the shooting, at the park, why were, you know.
Yeah, why were you there? Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was a constant roll of the dice and a lot of multitasking, a lot of juggling, a lot of different balls, keeping them up in the air.
Yeah. But fun, I'm sure.
Oh,
well, tell me the story. What happened with the FBI landing a helicopter on the tracks? What was that all about?
Well, first of all, you have to understand it is, you know, just 4 years after September 11th.
Oh yeah.
So the feds were real big on Homeland Security, and the event was designated as a national security event because there's so many people there, and it had the potential, if it was attacked, to do so much serious damage both to Chicago and the country. So yeah. It was designated as a national security event. So we started having all these planning meetings, and myself and, you know, people from a police department special functions section, which deal with crowd control, you know, we were good with the Sox. We had good working relationship with them. I mean, even when the Sox weren't playing, I was in there and just
sure.
talking to people and, you know, keeping up the lines of communication open. So we had it set from the police department side. The fire department, outstanding people, the special operations division, they were more concerned with the people being gassed or some sort of massive medical emergency.
Yeah.
And Dan O'Connell was the chief in charge of the hazmat team at the time. And we just clicked the first time we met, and between ourselves, we had it all worked out, and we had good rapport with the management there. And, you know, they told us, whatever you guys need, just let us know. We'll get it done. So I was very fortunate. The superintendent trusted me. He gave me pretty much of a blank check. Just tell him what we needed, what we wanted to do, and just be able to justify it. And he went along with it. And Dan, with the same thing with the fire department. So now we get a little bit closer. Now all of a sudden, the Sox have clinched.
Yeah.
The regular season's still going on. There's still a few games, but the Sox have clinched. So we know what's going to happen. We know the dates, and all of a sudden we get an email from the FBI and the Secret Service and the Marshal Service. We have to have this meeting about what's going on. We have to start our pre-planning. This is a national security event.
You guys are way ahead of them already. Yeah,
we've already got the plan. It's already down. You know, we've coordinated. It was just a like a Swiss watch. We had everything from the CTA to IDOT to the state police, CTA. Everything was covered. We had the plan. So now all of a sudden, the FBI shows up and they start having these meetings and. We want this, we want that, And oh, by the way, we'll need 25 passes for our agents to be on the premises. Yeah. Why do you need 25? Yeah. You know, well, we have national security concerns. We have to monitor the crowd and so forth.
Yeah.
So you got all this video stuff. And so the Sox basically, they knew what was going on. And they took the lead and just said, well, we'll talk about it. These are... Talk to O'Connell, talk to Roy. These are the guys.
Oh, you know, for them.
Good for them. So then some people just don't know how to take no for an answer. So all of a sudden, here's game one of the playoff series, and I get a call, go into the front office and see so-and-so.
Yeah.
There's a problem with somebody trying to get into the game. And I figured, don't tell me some some cop is trying to button his way into the game, you know, get
button
in for
his
free.
Way. That's funny.
Yeah. So go in there and sure, it's FBI agent.
Sure.
And he's got his kids with him.
He's putting the badge on.
Yeah, and he's, I'm here doing Homeland Security checks, and I need to get in, I need to be granted access.
These are my assistants.
And the Sox, they didn't middle me. They just said, you know what?
Wow.
You know, if you're here, fine, but your kids aren't law enforcement agents. We can't let them in. So we had a couple of incidents, and it got to the point they kept trying. And finally, it went very high in the Sox organization, and without naming names, somebody came out and said, there's only two people that say who gets in and gets out. It's either Frank Radke or Gene Roy. Frank or Gene say no, they're out. That's it.
Oh.
So anyway, we get this master plan, and there's a lot of moving pieces that go into this. And it was actually good training because we replicated a lot of this in 2012 with NATO.
Yeah.
And, for example, there used to be a train yard right there.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's also an active freight train line. So, of course, the fear is that somebody's going to put a bomb in a boxcar or poison in a boxcar or somebody's going to put a bomb in a train, something like that. So actually, everything was cleared out. The only trains that were allowed through were the Metro trains. You know, you just couldn't disrupt that schedule.
Yeah.
And I'm out walking around with my TAC lieutenant, and, hey, that helicopter's kind of low.
Yeah.
And why is something wrong? What's going on here? They land a helicopter on the railroad tracks.
Yeah.
And two guys in suits get out of it and climb down and go over there. And what was this all about? You know, because now, we're getting all these calls. What's this? Is there a helicopter crash? What's going on?
Yeah.
Oh, it was so-and-so from the FBI, and he had to monitor the situation and make a report to Washington. So he had to be put down there.
Yes. He wanted to go to the side.
And the thing is, you know, railroad tracks, they look sturdy, but actually if they get hit, they have to be reinspected, and they have to make sure that they weren't bent or they didn't come loose or anything. So it really disrupted. The railroads weren't too happy about it.
Wow.
Nobody was happy about it. The real cake, the one that took the cake, though, was the commissioner of baseball showed up. And it's Bud.
Who was it? Was it Peter Uberoff?
Bud Selig.
Oh, Bud Selig. Yeah.
And for some reason or another, his security was being provided by the U.S. Marshals.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, you know, my command post when I was there, I was on the northwest corner of 35th and Shields. That was my world. If you needed to see me, you needed to see my management team. Unless before the game or after the game, that's where we were. During the game, we were inside the park.
Yeah.
So we're standing there at my command post in 35th and Shields. And all of a sudden, we start hearing sirens, and we start seeing flashing lights. And here's these cars. You know, we had 35th Street blocked off.
Yeah.
Because we just want, again, you want to minimize the vehicle traffic so that nobody can bring a bomb or poison cannons and get that close to the stadium.
Yeah.
And just common sense. So all of a sudden, we hear the sirens. What's going on? Nobody's coming. The mayor's in, so there's no reason for anybody coming down the street with a siren. And here it is. The cars pull up by the front gate there, right on 35th and Shields there. And all of a sudden, these guys jump out. They're like Ninja Turtles in full combat gear. And I got their M4s out, and they're setting up a perimeter.
You gotta be kidding me.
And the baseball commissioner gets out of the limo and goes in. And you know,
he was a stroke anyway.
What was that all about? That was just totally ludicrous. But that's the kind of stuff we had to deal with.
Yes.
But
you know what? You had an interesting word. When somebody flashes a badge, that's the button.
Yeah.
Right.
It's old school talk.
Yeah. You know, I showed him the button. And I remember hearing a very funny story about a copper who's at Mass. And they're passing the basket, and he shows them the button. Like, that ain't going to work.
At least he didn't put his hand in the basket.
Yeah, exactly. All right, now, you see, he worked on some big cases. One of them I wanted to ask you about. First of all, there was a pregnant woman shot to death trick-or-treating on Halloween 2007. What the heck happened? That's a terrible tragedy.
Poor woman is out with her son, who's like 5 or 6. She's pregnant with another child. She's out with a group. They're trick-or-treating. They're around 47th and Hoyne.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of the most heavily gang-infested areas in the city, or was at the time. And two gangs started shooting at each other, and she was caught in a crossfire.
Oh,
and
wow.
She was killed. The fetus was killed.
Oh, man.
And I think the child was shot, but he survived. And obviously, it just provoked a whole storm. So that was one that was very, very interesting, very tricky, because one of the issues we had to work with. But first one is the language gap. We had a good number of Spanish-speaking officers in the 9th District.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you're dealing with a community that's probably 40 to 50% Hispanic, you never have enough. They're always, you need a Spanish interpreter tied up on a job or on another call or something like that. So that's a problem. And then the other problem, just like anywhere in the city, is getting people to cooperate with the police.
Yeah.
The problem in the back of the yards is due to immigration issues. A lot of people were very fearful of talking.
Illegal.
They're very afraid of talking to the police. So what we did is
You're investigating that crime. You know, you had to find out who did it.
Well, technically the detectives were in charge of the investigation, but the reality, the world of it, my marching orders from downtown were get this thing solved.
Yeah.
So it felt, no disrespect to the detectives, but it fell on me to get it done. And the way we did it is we had an officer who worked for me early when I was a new sergeant in the 13th District, and he had suffered a nearly career-ending injury, and he came back on the job, and he came to 9, and he worked for me as one of my TAC guys, and he just the type of person, he could talk to that light pole behind you and get the light pole to tell you what's going on in the garden here for the past 24 hours.
Yeah.
So he had the people skills. I teamed him up with another tech guy who was, or actually one of my former tech guys who was been promoted to detective, and he was Hispanic. And the two of them just started going to the schools in the neighborhood. And the culture in the neighborhood was such that every morning the moms would walk their kids to the school.
Yeah.
And then they would go down to the school lunchroom, and they would all have their coffee. They would have their sweets in the morning. So they had an informal mother's club meeting every day.
Yeah.
So these two guys just kept going to all these informal mother's clubs, and just started talking to people, built up trust, and it was classic police work. Hey, if you really want to help us, go get this guy. He stands on the corner. He sells marijuana to the kids.
Yeah.
Okay.
Went out,
worked on it, grabbed the kid, and he's no longer selling dope to the kids going to the school.
Yeah.
Okay, so now the mothers know and the community knows.
They trust you.
These two guys can be trusted.
Yeah.
And you keep building. We just kept building, and Eric and Joaquin, who were the two officers, just kept working on it, and they got to a certain level. And they were now they're locking up people that are on probation or parole. They don't want to go back to the joint.
Yeah.
So now they start talking. And we got it to that point, and we finally built up. We identified the shooters. We actually flipped an eyewitness, and we were able to make an arrest and solve that case.
Good for you.
Bring some peace to the neighborhood.
Wow. There's another I don't want to dwell on this, but a family of six was killed in Gage Park in 2016. Martinez family. What happened there? What was that all about?
What happened there is a gentleman who was supposed to work at the window washer at one of the airports didn't show up for work. His coworkers got concerned because he was very reliable, and he hadn't shown up for work for a couple of days. So he called the police. The police went to do a well-being check. The officers went. They didn't get an answer at the front door. They went to the back door and knocked on the door, and they saw, it turns out to be Grandma, lying on the floor outside the back door.
Oh.
They forced entry, and they found basically six bodies in there.
Wow.
The entire family.
Yeah. Have they been shot?
Only one had been shot. The rest had been stabbed.
Holy cow.
And this is one, it took us in several different directions. You know, of course, this is, the news media was all over it, and I'm trying to put together a plan. I was commander of the, or chief of the detectives at the time, trying to put together a plan, and every 5 seconds my phone is ringing off the hook because it's news affairs at the superintendent's office because, this is a Mexican cartel hit, this is a cartel hit.
Wow.
But we knew from the beginning that it wasn't any sort of organized gang or narcotics hit because it was very sloppy.
Yeah.
Nobody was handcuffed, nobody was bound, nobody was gagged. The sad part about it is there were two young boys, I think there were 9 and 11, and their mother was one of the victims, and we found them underneath a bed where they had been stabbed, and they were literally crawling, trying to get away from the offender who stabbed them.
Yeah.
We put an awful lot of work into it. I have to give credit where credit is due. The lieutenant from Area 1 Homicide, Ozzy Valdez, who just recently retired from the department, tireless, just put that case together. You know, the first thing is, so people understand what policemen go through.
Sure.
There's six bodies in his house.
Yeah.
There's blood everywhere.
Yeah.
It's like, there's blood everywhere. It's a mess. These officers were in that house the first night for 19 hours.
Oh, my God.
19 hours.
Yeah.
From the time they went home, got some sleep.
And had to go back.
Came back the next day. They were there for another five or 6 hours. So they, out of 2 days, they spent the whole day in it. And that's how the case was ultimately solved, was through blood blood samples that were recovered, their blood evidence. But in the meantime, we didn't have a real good starting point. So we did everything. I mean, we got people calling in saying it was cartels. We discounted that, but we still had to pursue
it. Follow it up,
We still had to pursue it. Then we heard there was family, and that really didn't pan out at that time. And then, you know, the family had been in there for some days. So what we did is, you know, all the CTA buses have cameras now.
Oh,
so we figured out the last time the family had been seen alive and the time they were discovered.
Yeah.
So we had to go and physically pull the video recordings off of every CTA bus that went up and down California during that, and sit there and watch it. I mean, it's not like you see on TV where you just hit a button and, there they are. You have to sit there and watch it minute for minute. We're just looking to see if anybody goes in or out of that house. Fortunately, what happened was we're just doing basic police work, good investigations, and we find that the gentleman who's ultimately identified as the offender, as the murderer.
He's no gentleman.
He's no gentleman at all.
Okay.
It's too much time in court.
That's exactly.
Can't gotta watch my PC
Q's.
Piece
of crap.
There. Yeah.
Okay.
And so the offender had come into where he worked, and he had some abrasions underneath his eye. And there was a retired Chicago police officer who worked there security.
No kidding.
And he put two and two together.
He figured it out.
Called my guys and said, you want to look at this guy? And they did, and it turned out that, you know, out of all the physical evidence they recovered, they got a couple drops of blood that were his blood. And he denied being in the house.
Yeah.
So that meant, well, if he denies being there, his blood is there. He's it.
Yeah.
We got him.
Yeah.
And it turned out...
What was his motive?
It turned out that the woman that he killed, the mother of the children, was married to his uncle. And his uncle had some immigration issues and had to go back to Mexico. And basically, he had to go back to Mexico and reset his time to get his visa renewed. Yeah. So he's coming back. It wasn't like he was banned or deported or anything like that. Just a normal thing. He blamed the mother for getting him deported and da-da-da-da-da. And then there was something about the she owed him some money. So he went over to collect money. She fought him. Yeah. He pulled out a gun and shot her. After he shoots her, her brother comes up. What's going on here? And he goes, and just every time somebody came up,
the
poor grandfather comes home. He'd gone out to a restaurant to get some carry out to bring home for the family's dinner.
Wow.
He walks in the door.
Yeah.
And they just got him and killed him.
Wow.
And is the killer and his accomplice, who was his
girlfriend.
Oh,
he had an accomplice.
His girlfriend.
A woman.
Yeah, his girlfriend. And really the sad part about it, I told you before about the two kids had crawled, we could see.
Crawled under the bed.
Crawled underneath the bed. They saw some of the stuff, so what he did is he told the kids, go with my girlfriend. She's going to get you packed up, and we're going to go home to Mexico and see your dad. We're taking you to see your dad.
Yeah.
And that's when they stabbed him and killed him.
Talk about evil. You know, and what are we doing on time here? Okay, I want to get into what you're doing now, but this is a good segue because this takes a toll on the police officers involved. Mentally, physically, yes, mentally.
Mentally.
And so tell me a little bit about first responder wellness, and then let's take it into Operation Backup.
You know, I saw a lot of stuff going on there, and I saw the reactions on the officers and the detectives who worked for me. And that's when I really renewed my interest and sparked my interest in officer wellness. Because if you don't deal with this stress, if you keep it bottled up inside yourself, yeah. it will kill you just as surely as getting hit by a bus.
Yeah.
It's going to destroy your heart, destroy your lungs, destroy your brain. It's toxic. So in my retirement, I had to do something in retirement. You know, I'm a purpose-driven person. I need a reason to get up in the morning. So I started getting involved in officer wellness and learning what the symptoms. And the trick is to prevent officers from getting to the point where they have PTSD.
Yes.
We see something horrific like that. Our brains are hardwired for what's normal and what's not normal. And we see stuff that's abnormal, it provokes those physical reactions in us. Now, if we talk and we get them out, they're still going to be with us, but they're not going to have that much power on us.
Yeah.
But if you stuff them inside, you don't talk about it, you try and be that old, tough guy, hey, forget about it, kid, this is the job you signed up for.
Yeah.
Those days are gone.
Right. Thank God.
Don't do that. Yeah. You know, so the main thing is get the cops to know that they can talk to people. There's people out there, whether it's their peers, you know, just talking over a beer at a place like this. Hey, that was a bad week we had last week.
Yeah.
Or maybe they need to go see a clinician because it's a little bit more serious.
Yeah.
Knowing that, letting them know that there's people out there that can help them, and they can't keep this stuff bottled up.
Right.
You know, their dad's police department, their grandfather's police department is gone. Those days of suck it up and move on, they're over.
Right.
So that really became one of my passions in life. And, I went to some training, and I'm certified peer counselor, and I'm also part of the Northern Illinois Critical Incident Stress Management Team, which goes out and does debriefings for officers in the smaller departments where when they've been confronted with some sort of horrific situation.
Yeah. And you say, hey, I've been there, right?
I've been there. Been there and done that, unfortunately. Yeah. And you got two choices. You want to go down this road or you want to go down that road?
Yeah.
You know, and let's talk about it. More importantly, give people a chance to vent and let them know that what they're feeling is not abnormal. It's a normal reaction to an abnormal event.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that's what I've been doing. A couple of weeks ago, the police department went to an operational tempo.
We had John Kentenzar on a couple of weeks ago. He's telling us all about it.
Yep.
No days off.
No
12-hour shifts. It's terrible.
And the officers were only given 48 hours notice that was going to happen.
Yeah.
So a few other retirees and myself and a couple of neighbors over here in the neighborhood were talking, what can we do to help? And let's do something. You know, what's tough on the cops is, you know, they have to go to work. They understand that. But you're still a part of a family.
You're a dad, a mom. Yeah.
You know, you've got kids to be taken care of. You got a house to take care of. You got the lawn to mow. The garbage has got to go out.
Babysitters.
And stuff like that. So why don't we set something up where we could get retirees like ourselves that could, you know, who are a known quantity. You know, everybody from the neighborhood knows each other.
Yeah.
You know, and trust each other. And, you know, let's help them out with this stuff. And, okay, well, how are we going to get it out? Well, let's use social media.
Yeah.
It's a powerful tool. So
that's how I saw it.
That's what we did.
Yeah.
So we just put it up, and from Friday until the following Friday, we had 1,000 people to sign up to volunteer to help cops.
That's terrific.
And just all sorts of other people. We did a lot of the household stuff. You know, people were out mowing lawns.
Yeah.
As silly as it seems, walking dogs.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're a dog owner and there's nobody there to walk the dog, it's not silly.
Yeah, you don't want to step in it when you get home.
Exactly. So, you know, we got those done. But at the same time, people said, well, I want to feed these guys. I want to give them some water.
Yeah.
I want Gatorade and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we expanded into that, too, where we were able to find some sponsors who provided stuff like that. And we delivered
I think that's
food
terrific.
And refreshments to officers. Yeah. And we're going to be doing
it
again.
And you're still doing it.
We're going to be doing it again this weekend because they're back on the 12-hour shifts. No days off this weekend.
That's terrible.
And then the following weekend for Father's Day weekend. Yeah. It'll be the same way.
And Father's Day weekend and all these fathers on the force.
Yep.
And,
And, you know, and then 4th of July.
Yeah.
So
if somebody wants to help, how do they help? Operation Backup.
Operation Backup. Go to banktheblue.org.
Bank the Blue, like a bank,
Bank the Blue, and it's got a drop-down screen on there, you know, how you can be involved.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's banktheblue.com.
Okay.
Banktheblue.com. Thank
you. I'm glad you have advisors.
To my staff here. Yeah. Banktheblue.com. There's a drop-down menu, how you can get involved.
Banktheblue.com.
Right.
It's also on Facebook.
It's also on Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've got a little more flexibility in a web page. We yeah. sort of, as far as connecting people who need help and so forth, we sort of outgrew Facebook. So now
sure.
the website, and also the website of people.
Banktheblue.com.
Right. Yeah. And people want to donate. Instead of them going to Costco or something or
sure.
county fair
yeah.
and buying pop of water, they're paying taxes when they make it,
yeah.
when they make that purchase. So if they make a donation to Bank the Blue, we get out there, we will deliver to
More
the officers.
Get it. Yeah.
They get a tax deduction, and because oh. we're a registered charity, you know, we're tax exempt. So that dollar, for each dollar, you know, if Joe Citizen goes to County Fair to buy water,
yeah.
he's getting 90 cents on the dollar because yeah. the other 10 cents is in
sure.
tax.
Yeah.
He gives us a dollar, that whole dollar goes towards food and refreshments for the officers.
Well, I think that's just terrific, and I admire you. God bless you for doing that. We got to wrap this up, but keep me informed of how Bank the Blue is doing.
We certainly
Any
will.
Officer, and we got a lot of officers who listen to the show. They should know that Gene Roy is helping Bank the Blue.
Banktheblue.com.
Okay. Thanks, pal. God bless you so
My
much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Terrific being with you.
Right.
We're going to take a little break on Hibernian Radio. We'll be right back after these messages from our friends.
Chicago firefighters first formed an independent firemen's association in 1901. Firefighter delegates met in 1918 at the American Federation of Labor Convention to form the International Association of Firefighters. Chicago, having been the second organization to join the American Federation of Labor, they were designated as IAFF Local 2. Over the next 100 years or so, Local 2 has been tempered through turbulent times and survived to prosper. In 1980, a contentious strike almost split the union, but the Brotherhood of the Barrel prevailed. Today, it's a stronger union because of that, as Local 2 is forever negotiating benefits for their members. Ask any of the members and they will tell you, as the faces of our ranks change over time, the men and women of Local 2 will always stand steadfast in our resolve to aid and assist those who find themselves in dire situations. Our brotherhood is our bond, and we celebrate our differences as a way to better serve the citizens of Chicago and keep each other safe. For more info, go to IAFF2.org.
Flood Brothers Disposal was started over 90 years ago by their grandfather. With more than 20 family members still involved with day-to-day operations, the Floods are service-oriented and believe that the right way is the only way to do something. Flood Brothers are price competitive and still offer the personal touch in an industry-trending corporate. For client-centric service without all of that corporate garbage, call Flood Brothers today for a quote on your solid waste, recycling, and yard waste collection services. Call Bob Flood today at 630-261-0400 or go online at floodbrothersdisposal.com. Welcome back to the Flood Brothers.
Hey, everybody. This is Charlotte Houlihan. Don't touch that dial. My grandpa will be right back some more Hibernian Radio. He said something about seeing a man about a horse. Sounds like I'm actually going to get that pony after all.
Irish American News has been bringing you the news important to the Irish in Chicagoland for over 40 years. If you like mostly good news and information from all aspects of the Irish community, check out Irish American News. To advertise or subscribe, call our friend Cliff Carlson at 847-872-0700 or email him at cliff@irishamericannews.com. Irish American News, we've always been green.
On the death walk of saloons that decorate Western Avenue, only the Cork and Kerry Irish Pub, the soul of Beverly, sits right on a 50-yard line of Chicago's Southside Irish St. Patrick's Day Parade at 106th and Western. Generations of Southside Irish have quenched their thirst in the Cork, snuggling up to memories of family, faith, and fierce loyalty to friends. It's the jewel of this neighborhood where we celebrated weddings, christenings, wakes, and unforgettable victories. Proprietors Bill Guidy and Mike Fitzpatrick, now celebrating 20 years in business, welcome you home for a cold brew, to share a good story, or help you throw one hell of a party. With over 20 beers on tap and a full bar for your pleasure, this is the spot you can sink a root and get your Irish on. Cork has plenty of seating, from our private event rooms to our 300-person beer garden. Our interior space brings you back to the homeland of Ireland with our vintage photos and authentic Irish decor and Chicago memories of the good old days. So say hello to a stranger, make a new friend, fall in love, or just enjoy the company of people you forgot you knew. The Cork and Kerry continues the Southside tradition parents and grandparents brought here from the old country. Come on by the Cork and Kerry and get some. The Cork and Kerry Irish Pub, 10614 Southwestern Avenue, for private parties, just pals hanging out, or intimate cocktail rendezvous. Come on home to the south side of Chicago at the Cork and Kerry.
And we're back on Hibernian Radio. Hey, what a great guest. Gene Roy, that's a great organization. Bank the Blue, back up, helping their fellow police officers. Throw them some dough. Get online. BankTheBlue.com. We want them to keep doing what they're doing because this is going to be a tough, tough summer for our brothers in blue. So let's do the best we can for them and also keep them in your prayers. That's an important thing as well. All right, I got some stories I want to tell you. I went to see my old pal Johnny Cola the other day. I was out at the north side seeing my buddy Gino Cooney and swung by the Landmark Pub. Big John's Landmark Pub, established in 1938. John is an old friend of mine. It's in Harwood Heights, 5135 North Oriole Avenue at Foster Avenue. Check it out. It's a great little pub. John is a good friend of mine. He has a lot of parties, and he also is a big supporter of the police. And if you go in there, you tell John Cola that Hooli sent you, and he might give you an extra toothpick with your drink or something. But I used to own Big John's Belmont Club on Belmont, too. So I wanted to make sure that I plug him because he's an old pal and a good friend. And God bless Big John's Landmark Pub. Also, you know, we got this film we're working on and working on. And hopefully we're going to premiere it in September at the 7th Annual Irish American Movie Hooli, September 24th. The movie is In Search of Weeping Jim. Go to weepingjim.org. You can go there. You can see preview of the film, see the trailer. You can make a donation. We need your help if you want to be part of the film. Everybody who makes a donation gets to be included in the closing credits. But an interesting thing that has happened, we're going to premiere the film in September. We're also going back to Ireland October 20th to the 27th. We're going to premiere the film in Ireland, in Westport, right outside Kilmina Inishcuttle, County Mayo, where we filmed a lot of the stuff. Don't know the exact date of the film, the screening, but we're going to be in Ireland October 20th to 27th. You'll be hearing more about that in the Irish American News and stuff. We'd love to have you join us. We only have room for 40 people. It's one of the trips you will never, ever forget for the rest of your life. I'll be booking a gorgeous Irish musician to join us, and it's a lot of fun. 7 days in Ireland. You won't be sorry. Ask anybody who ever went with us. Also, our friends at the Emerald Society of Illinois, are having their Rib Fest Monday, July 19th. Don't forget this. It's 7 o'clock, 7 to 11, over at FOP Lodge 7, 1412 West Washington Boulevard. It's 4 hours. It's free. Of course, you pay for the food. But it's a great night. The Emerald Society Rib Fest. I went with my son, Patty, last year. We had a blast. Had a couple of plates. Monday, July 19th, 2020 at 7 p.m. to 11 p.m., Emerald Society of Illinois Rib Fest. Rib Face. That's what I got, Rib Face. And also, don't forget their store, EmeraldSocietyOfIllinois.org, I think it is. You can buy jackets, hats, T-shirts, all that stuff. All the Emerald Society materials. Let me just see it. And this is from my old buddy, Jeff Lang. EmeraldSocietyOfIllinois.org. That's it. The online store. Don't forget the Rib Fest, July 19th at the FOP. 7 o'clock. I'll be there. We'll lift a jar together. Okay, Billy, you know, whenever I'm walking down Western Avenue and look at the window of Ken's, Wrong's, Hart's, any of those great Irish saloons, I see the ghost of my old pal, Jimmy Goff, through the mist, and he says to me, "Hey, Wooly, who died?" Okay, Patrick Andy Devine. His nickname was Andy. Get it? Andy Devine. Oh, Wild Bill, wait for me. jingles. Patrick Bernard Devine, more commonly known as Andy, 68, passed away last week. He was a loving husband of 42 years to Nancy Nano, Nee Chasen, loving father of Kelly, Christy, and his son Patrick Devine, big brother to Tim Devine, fond uncle, cousin, nephew, and friend to many. Andy was a proud graduate of Mendel High School, the Mendel Monarchs. Mendel men are gentlemen, and also St. Zabs, co-owner of Marathon Sportswear for 30 years, basketball coach, life of the party, and king of jokes. You can't ask for a better obit than that. And, of course, he was waked, and the funeral services were handled by Sheehy, where all the right people go. Bridget McGinley, 92, native of Kilchimaa, County Mayo, Ireland. Loving mother of Peter, the late Ellen, James, Joe, Christine, Brendan, and Ed. Longtime and wonderful caregiver to her dear friend Elizabeth and many others. God rest her lovely soul, Bridget McGinley. Mary T. Gillespie, 91. Beloved wife of the late John Jack Gillespie Sr., whom she married in March of 51. Loving mother of John Jr. Gillespie of Addison, Peter Gillespie of Winfield, Brian Gillespie of Winfield, the late Kathleen, and the late Teresa Ann Gillespie. Adored grandmother of 14 and cherished great-grandmother of 12. Mary grew up in Chicago's Austin neighborhood, Siena High School. God rest her lovely soul, Mary T. Gillespie. And finally, Mary A. O'Keefe, Nee Joslin, age 78, devoted mother of Kathleen. She was waked. And the funeral services were handled by Sheehy, where all the right people go. All right, we're going to close up the crypt here. Take our final break. We'll be right back for a quick wrap-up. Stick around. With a history going all the way back to 1896, the International Union of Operating Engineers has continued to protect workers and their families with loyalty and brotherhood. Local 150 has continued to thrive through economic booms and busts, with careful training and aggressive organizing. Under the leadership of President and Business Manager Jim Sweeney, Local 150 has implemented programs and action plans to create work, protect benefits, and keep members working. And they've been helping the Irish-American community of Chicagoland for just as long. The Hibernian Radio Show is proud to be associated with Jim Sweeney and Local 150, and we salute the continuing efforts of the International Union of Operating Engineers and their support of Irish and Irish-American families now and in the future. Thanks to Local 150. When your family has suffered a loss, there's one family I know who will be there for you. Robert J. Sheehy & Sons Funeral Homes are third-generation, family-owned and operated. The Sheehy family has dedicated their lives serving families throughout Chicago and the southwest suburbs. The Robert J. Sheehy & Sons Funeral Home was incorporated in 1913 as a storefront at 76th and Halsted in Chicago. At the time, this was one of the few standalone funeral homes of its kind and was to be the first of many to come bearing the Sheehy name. The founder, Roger Sheehy Sr., was soon joined in business by his three sons, Roger Jr., Jack, and Bob. This trademark of service is evident 98 years later, as Bob and Jim Sheehy, third generation, own and operate two locations in Orland Park and Burbank. At Sheehy's, the name on their sign outside the funeral home means something. For them, it's very important that everyone be treated as if they were family, friend, or neighbor, as they very well could be. When my brother Willie died a few years ago, the Sheehys took very good care of our family. And you know, you never forget something like that. Their entire staff cares about each and every family they serve. Every detail is handled in a professional and personal manner. On a daily basis, the directors Bill Kiley, Mike LaRock, and John Sullivan, and the rest of the staff, take great pride in their work, serving families as if they were their own. Bob Sheehy will tell you, we pride ourselves on offering the highest level of professionalism with every family we serve. Robert J. Sheehy & Sons Funeral Homes, here for you since 1913.
Irish American News has been bringing you the news important to the Irish in Chicagoland for over 40 years. If you like mostly good news and information from all aspects of the Irish community, check out Irish American News. To advertise or subscribe, call our friend Cliff Carlson at 847-872-0700 or email him at cliff@irishamericannews.com. Irish American News, we've always been green.
Hey folks, Charlotte Houlihan here. Did you know that Hibernian Radio is now streaming worldwide on Global Irish Radio? Every Saturday night at 7 p.m. or 1 a.m. in Ireland. Yes, the Irish are always way ahead of us. Check it out at globalirishradio.com or capital GIR.ie.
Southsiders have always known where to get the best pizza on earth, Fox's Pizza. For over a half century, the Fox family has been creating that delicious thin crust za that your mouth will tell you, this can only be Fox's. It's a Chicago Beverly institution at 99th and Western, as well as in Orland Park, where they combine delicious food with an Irish pub ambiance. You got the best of both worlds. Still owned by Tom and Frank Fox, whose mom and dad, Frank and Teresa, bought the Western location from Al Capone's sister back in 1964. They opened the doors in Orland at 73 at 143rd and Ravinia Avenue. You'll recognize the stone turrets of their Irish castle, whose great times have been celebrated for generations of Chicagoland Irish. Fox's is perfect for the whole family, pickup or delivery, or you can dine in, relax, and have a cocktail with your dinner, whether it's steak, ribs, chicken, or especially pizza. It's all good. Having a party? Fox's also does catering. Call Fox's in Beverly at 773-239-3212 or in Orland Park at 708-349-2111. They're proud sponsors of Hibernian Radio and all Irish first responders. Mention this show for a free toothpick. Gotta love that Fox's Pizza.
Flood Brothers Disposal was started over 90 years ago by their grandfather. With more than 20 family members still involved with day-to-day operations, the Floods are service-oriented and believe that the right way is the only way to do something. Flood Brothers are price competitive and still offer the personal touch in an industry-trending corporate. For client-centric service without all of that corporate garbage, call Flood Brothers today for a quote on your solid waste recycling and yard waste collection services. Call Bob Flood today at 630-261-0400 or go online at floodbrothersdisposal.com. Welcome back to the Flood Brothers.
And we're back, and so glad to have you all with us. Hey, final joke. Please join us any Wednesday night here at Cork and Kerry. We're here every Wednesday night with a member of the police, fire, or paramedic groups, are modern-day equivalent to our mythological Irish warriors. Okay, a pregnant woman got shot three times and recovered, but the bullets were never found. Later, she had triplets, two girls and one boy. Many years later, the first girl came up to her mom and told her about how she peed out a bullet. The next day, the second girl came up and mother said, "Let me guess, you peed out a bullet too." She was right. The next day, her young son came up to his mom and says, "Mom, I'm so ashamed of what just happened." The mother replies, "Oh, honey, it's all right. Your sister's peed out a bullet, too. It's nothing to be ashamed of." "No, that's not it," he said. "I was rubbing my willy, and I think I shot the dog." Okay. You wanted a spicy one, and you got it. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week. What a great show tonight. Let me just see if I got who our guest is tomorrow or next week. Tim McCarthy from the Chicago Fire Department is on the show next week. Come on by. God bless you all. Thank you so much, and we'll see you later. Bye.
Oh, Lord, I wonder, will I look down? Started walking, and I was fine.
All right.